He was a Christian apologist, born in the age of Shakespeare. He was a questioner of faith, a doctor whose skull would be stolen after his burial. He knew no fewer than 6 languages, and he would be knighted by King Charles II. Let's go meet Thomas Brown. Maybe you got lost somewhere, swimming too far off the beach, off the coastline. Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Cause. My name is Rob, and today we're going to be discussing the 5th book in the 3rd volume of the Harvard Classic series, The Religio Medici by Sir Thomas Brown. This is actually concludes the 3rd volume of the Harvard Classic series, so we'll be moving into the 4th pretty soon, so looking forward to that. Religio Medici translates into something like The Religion of a Doctor. It is a very unique book, in my opinion, because of how it is written, the topics it covers, and also the age of Thomas Brown when he wrote it. I also must admit, my expectations of the Religio Medici by Thomas Brown was not that high. I had never heard of Thomas Brown, and the title honestly didn't sound that interesting. But it was honestly anything but boring. This will be the first outright religious text in Harvard Classic series. John Woolman was close, but it wasn't quite a complete religious text. So let's discuss a brief history of Thomas Brown, and then we'll transition into the Religio Medici. Thomas Brown was born in London, 1605. Now, John Milton was born in 1608, and Bacon was born in 1561. So all 3 men in Volume 3 would have lived around the same time period. This period included the works of Shakespeare, and also the King James Bible. And as you will see, Thomas Brown's writing form, his vocabulary, and his style is much like the other authors we have mentioned previously. Brown was educated at Winchester in Oxford and would train in the practice of medicine. He would marry and have 10 children. Sadly, only 4 would live to survive him. He wrote the Religio Medici around the age of 30, so around 1635. And like Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, it wasn't meant to go out to the public. It was apparently leaked by a friend or an acquaintance. And then Brown would actually publish the Religio Medici in the 1640s to kind of clear up any discrepancies that had been put out there. Now, this work became a bestseller, and it would allow him to rise in popularity rather quickly. Brown is witty. He's diverse in the subjects that he discusses, and he brings up things that make you think at times and sometimes even blush. He would be knighted late in life by King Charles II, and ironically, he would die on his birthday, October 19th, at the age of 77. With that being said, let's discuss his works, the Religio Medici. Now, to be clear from the start, this is a Christian Protestant apology that Brown is writing to defend his faith. During a time when the world was changing, Brown starts off the book by saying that he is indeed a Christian, and that he assumes the style of a Christian, but that the term Christian has faced, in his words, the fatal corruption of times so decayed, impaired, and fallen from its native beauty that it required the careful and charitable hands of these times to restore it to its primitive integrity. I wonder what he would think about it today. Right from the start, we realize Brown is not timid when it comes to discussing controversial ideas. With reason as his shield and wit as his dagger, he seems to minimize the controversy and he sets the reader at ease. He also chooses to cloak himself with humbleness right from the start, thereby minimizing any judgments that may be cast upon him from his statements. He says, "I can never divide myself from any man upon the difference of opinion, or be angry with his judgment for not agreeing with me, and that from which perhaps within a few days I should dissent myself." So we catch a glimpse of this humble willingness to change his mind. And when somebody says something like that, I think it's kind of implied that you should feel the same way as well. Therefore, if I'm not willing to really judge you, then please don't judge me. Now, if new evidence is presented and a more factual truth is uncovered, then why not change your mind? Where we desire to be informed, 'tis good to contest with men above ourselves, but to confirm and establish our opinions, 'tis best to argue with judgments below our own. That's a good practice to put in place for many things in life. I like how he uses the word contest with men above ourselves rather than agree with or learn from. Contest with them. Challenge the argument until you can explain the subject that is in question to someone completely and diligently. Then do you really understand it yourself? At this point, he moves into some discrepancies of the Bible that people have most likely always kind of poked at. He says, "Where I cannot satisfy my reason, I love to humor my fancy." He questions the serpent in Genesis, which made his motion on his belly before the curse God put upon him, or the dove that left Noah's ark and never returned? How did it populate? Brown says reason makes him question the most minute details. Was Adam a hermaphrodite before Eve? Was Adam created with the organ of reproduction, or given that organ after his wife was created from his rib? This is what Brown will bring up later. It kind of makes you think, but then at the same time, kind of blush. Valid questions, but the only way to really discover the answer is if you're willing to die and ask the big man upstairs. There were two books from which Brown said he collected his divinity. One was written by God, and the other was God's servant, nature. Those that never saw him in one have discovered him in the other. Even the heathens, though they don't find God, find the works of God. If you have to be a Christian to get to heaven, then what about the humans that have never been introduced to God or Jesus? Surely our benevolent Savior would have mercy on their souls. Brown challenges to think about that for a bit. Now, the biggest takeaway from the book is presented next, in my opinion. It is a very simple concept, but one that I think many of us struggle with. There are two main causes that have perverted the devotion of many to atheism: reason and passion. You see, we forget about faith, especially in our younger years when we are trying to navigate reason and put a why to everything. But why? Why is it that way? He says, as reason is a rebel unto faith, so passion unto reason. As the propositions of faith seem absurd unto reason, so the theorems of reason unto passion, both unto faith. You can see this throughout time periods in history. Before the Enlightenment and the Renaissance, the world operated on more of a blind faith. Brown himself is a product of the Renaissance, and he sees his world moving away from faith into reason. So during this period, there's a huge shift into reason, which can be a challenger to faith. A Christian who chooses to travel down the studies of philosophy and science embarks on a journey that will challenge faith, a test on faith, a challenge to tradition, and this path may possibly break your faith before you make it out the other end. C.S. Lewis is a marvelous example of this, although he was able to come back. Can you balance theology, science, and philosophy in one hand and keep the faith in the other? Let's add the third ingredient and increase the burden on faith even more. In our more modern Western society, we have started to drop faith and reason altogether. Remove God, diminish reason, and through passion, you can control. Passion is the focus of our society today. We always hear the gurus telling us to find your passion. Do what makes you happy. Make yourself happy. How we feel, how things make us look, the desires and passions of the collective thought over individual reason. Nothing is completely wrong with any of these three: faith, reason, and passion. But like all things in life, moderation of these three is key. A world based solely on faith can be corrupted and abused, such as the Spanish Inquisition and the periods of witch burning. Brown himself believed in witches and burning them. And a world based on reason alone creates Darwin and the idea of eugenics. With a good dose of reason, you can reason almost anything. Stoicism is a great example of minimizing faith and eliminating passion and focusing only on reason. Like Epictetus said, "I must die, but must I die bawling?" Reason is what entices us to explore the contradictions of scripture and question everything. Now, a world based on passion alone can tear down age-old establishments, which were created around faith and reason, just to realize they do not have the tools or the knowledge to build anything better. Ponder on this section for a bit when you read it. We all need to think about the consequences of not getting faith, reason, and passion aligned correctly. I think this is a brilliant observation by Thomas Brown. Bringing the devil into it, he said, "And whilst I labored to raise the structure of my reason, he strived to undermine the edifice of my faith." I love the transparency here. We're all tempted, and we shouldn't be ashamed of the temptation, because the evil spirit is going to win sometimes. Just don't allow it to become a habit. And then next, Brown himself turns to passion. "And herein I must accuse those of my own religion, for there is not any of such a fugitive faith, such an unstable belief as a Christian." He continues on this with some examples of their times, but we can see it today as well. The church is not rigid anymore. It's pliable, and it now molds to ideas and customs that undermines its original integrity, changing through passion and reason by relinquishing faith. He then moves into the other religions of the world, and I will be honest, he does not appear to think too highly of the Turks, Jews, or Mahometans, as he calls them. I don't think this was a singular belief by him or his culture. From my readings, it seems to be a view held by most cultures in this geographical area, because he is commenting from the point of religious conversion more than the character of the individual person. He mentions the persecution of the Jews in this period, and he adds a very good line, showing compassion somewhat for a people that does not hold his views. Persecution is a bad indirect way to plant religion. Persecution is a bad way to plant anything. Obedience out of fear is built on a very fragile foundation, whereas obedience out of faith and love can be more lasting. Next, he brings up the issue that we've kind of all endeavored to think about at some point. There is an organ for reason, the brain, but no organ for the soul, unless you consider like the body, or I guess some portion of the brain where reason is held. He says, "Thus we are men, and we know not how. There is something in us that can be without us, and will be after us. Though it is strange that it hath no history what it was before us, nor cannot tell us how it entered in us." It's the age-old question, even asked by Socrates and Phaedo. And like Brown has mentioned previously, once we reach the limits of our reason, the only hope is to have faith strong enough to bridge the gap of understanding. Brown says, "I do not understand, yet dare not therefore deny." A doctor that speaks over six languages simply says, "I don't understand, therefore I have to have faith." But even when we have faith and we have sound reason, we can still let life get the best of us. "I find my growing judgment daily instruct me how to be better, but my untamed affections and confirmed vitriosity make me daily do worse. I find in my confirmed age that the same sins I discovered in my youth, I committed many then, because I was a child. And because I commit them still, I am yet an infant." This one hits home, because it makes you think about the errors you have still yet to fix. You had an excuse when you were young, but at the age of 30, 50, 70, what is your excuse now? You know better, but you choose at this point to sin and be immoral. The younger you take care of your business and fix your issues, the better your life will be down the road. Brown will then bring up Stoicism in a positive light. And truly, there are pieces in the philosophy of Zeno and doctrines of the Stoics, which I perceive, delivered in a pulpit, pass for current divinity. Some of the Stoic teachings are very relatable to Christianity, and I thought that was kind of cool that he seemed to have recognized that as well. Now, I don't know about y'all, but recently my mind has been wrestling with the current state of our country. I live here in the U.S., down in Louisiana, and I have really had to step back and not let the passion of the times weigh on me. So this next line was very relatable. "That general opinion that the world grows near its end hath possessed all ages past as nearly as ours." Such a good daily reminder as we navigate life in this year. The end has always been near, but life will continue to move on regardless of our fear. In keeping on the topic of society for the moment, it is important we discuss virtue. I know it's like a broken record in my videos at this point. There is no road or ready way to virtue. It is not an easy point of art to disentangle ourselves from this riddle or web of sin. The more acceptable this web of sin becomes, the less virtue we will witness. But when you see it, virtue shines bright. It's attacked by the many and it's honored by the few. Virtue is indeed it's not an easy path to go down, if it has ever been. We naturally know what is good, but naturally pursue what is evil. Evil, in my opinion, is just easy. It's easier to give in to sin than to fight the temptations. Why accept the consequences of the truth when all I gotta do is tell a lie? It's easier to smite your enemy than it is to hold out your hand and offer a handshake. Sin is easy. It can be fun, enjoyable. It has even become cool to be moral and tear down things. Some members of society even glorify it now. But beware of the quiet, virtuous monster. There is a depraved appetite in us that will with patience hear the learned instructions of reason, but yet perform no farther than agrees to its own irregular humor. In brief, we are all monsters. That is a composition of man and beast. It is those dark thoughts that you are capable of having, but you will most likely never bring to the public. It is realizing that what you are capable of doing, you should maybe keep locked away. Thousands of years of war and hardship have created a monster that lives within all of us. Faith and reason holds that monster in check, but when the time is necessary, passion is unleashed, and historical events usually follow. Civil life to me is nothing more than the multitude constantly taming the monster inside of us all. That's why we should read history and learn what monstrous things from the past that could possibly happen again if allowed. Next, we move into the second part of the Religio Medici. There is a first part. I don't think I mentioned that, but there is part one and part two of the Religio Medici. So now we're going to be moving into the second part. Part two is shorter, and it's mostly the concept of charity and the derivatives of charity. Charity can be many things. We think of it nowadays as just handing out money to the church or to the poor, or also outsourcing charity to our highly efficient government and allowing them to use it on the charitable activities of their choosing via taxes. And if you look around, especially Louisiana, they have done an amazing job. Now, I do state that with a little sprinkle of sarcasm. But charity can be more than that. It can be simply sharing knowledge and skills. I make not therefore my head a grave, but a treasure of knowledge. I intend no monopoly, but a community in learning. I study not for my own sake, but for theirs that study not for themselves. Charity can be mentoring a young man or a woman that needs guidance, starting a community garden to provide healthy food for the needy. Charity has been hijacked, in my opinion, over the past few years, but we'll save that for a separate video. They that endeavor to abolish vice destroy virtue. For when vice gains upon the major part, virtue, in whom it remains, becomes more excellent. The scarcity of virtue going forward will allow it to increase in value over time. The more rare it becomes, the more people will appreciate it. He also has this line here that I think is so simple, but it holds great value. No man can judge another because no man knows himself. So simply put, we censure those who disagree with us, and we commend others for simply just having the same point of view as we do. If you are not on my political football team, then you're an idiot. Having an understanding of yourself, with your ego removed, your passion in check, and your motives in the open, reveals a human that is still not capable of truly judging others. Also on the topic of judgment, he has this line, "From a disposition in a few, conclude a habit in all." We may only have the knowledge of a single element or a small soundbite, but yet we judge everybody in that group to be less or irrelevant. I thought about how dangerous they could be, and I concluded that the key word there is few, because if you switch it around from the disposition of many, we can conclude a habit in most. That should be a trait we all work on, giving a little more grace and judging just a little bit less. In keeping on the subject of knowledge and obtaining knowledge, a good point is brought up. It kind of ties into what we call imposter syndrome nowadays. For, indeed, heads of capacity, and such as are not full with a handful or easy measure of knowledge, think they know nothing till they know all, which being impossible, they fall upon the opinion of Socrates, and only know they know not anything. This is why starting anything new is intimidating. At surface level, things look easy, such as roasting coffee. But then you dive down the rabbit hole and you realize this is going to take a long time to figure out, and it's going to take years to hone your craft. We have to be okay with that. Because, first of all, everything you learn is not always correct either. So we have to be comfortable with unlearning just as much as we are with learning. We do but learn today what our better advanced judgments will unteach tomorrow. That is such an important thing to understand as you get older. It is okay to unlearn things as you realize a higher truth or a higher justice. Do not hold on to a lie out of pride, guilt, or pressure from the modern mob. In fact, unlearning may sometimes be just as important as learning. Now, I was about to leave out the next part because I know there are some younger viewers that watch the channel. But to do so would miss an opportunity to accurately portray Thomas Brown's mind. So in regards to sex, disclaimer here, he says, "I could be content that we might procreate like trees without conjunction, or that there were any way to perpetuate the world without this trivial and vulgar way of union. It is the foolishest act a wise man commits in all his life. Nor is there anything that will more deject the cooled imagination when he shall consider what an odd and unworthy folly he hath committed." Now, Brown was not married at the time of writing this, and I do not know what his level of expertise in this art may have been, but he does not view the concept of bumping uglies in the most flattering light. Now, Brown will talk about almost anything, and he has such a polite and elegant way of saying it that it makes it almost beautiful in its own way. It makes his writing different and unique. Most of the previous books in the Harvard Classics have not had the best endings. The point just kind of comes to a conclusion, and they're like, that's it, take or leave it, the book is done. Now, Socrates' apology was a pretty good ending. "The hour of departure has arrived, and we go our ways, I to die, and you to live. Which is better, God only knows." I still love that one. But Brown, he leaves us with something different. I love what he has here for what happiness would be for him. "Bless me in this life with but peace of my conscience, command of my affections, the love of thyself and my dearest friends. And I shall be happy enough to pity Caesar. These are, O Lord, the humble desires of my most reasonable ambition, and all I dare call happiness on earth. wherein I set no rule or limit on thy hand or providence. Dispose of me according to the wisdom of thy pleasure. Thy will be done, though in my own undoing. How beautiful is that? That last line, though in my own undoing, is important. Christians love to use the phrase, just use me for your will, dear God. But sometimes it may be by your death. Are you willing to give all for his plans? Seriously. Right now, as a new mom, a new dad, not understanding why. Some in this life have, and some in this life will. So just something to stay aware of before you commit such a statement to God. With that being said, guys, I truly hope you enjoyed my take on Thomas Brown's Religio Medici. I will link the book in the description below. If you don't have the Harvard Classics set, they actually sell individual books of the title. Also, the entire Harvard Classics set can be purchased on Kindle for like very, very cheap. So if you have a Kindle or something like that and you want to follow along that way, and I will have a link in there to the Harvard Classics Kindle as well. So this wraps up volume 3 of the Harvard Classics. We have 47 more volumes to go through, which sounds insane at this point. But next we move into volume 4, which we go back to John Milton, and we'll start discussing more of his poetry, and we'll go into Paradise Lost and stuff like that, which I'm really looking forward to because I've heard so much about it. I have never read it to this point, so I'm really looking forward to that. I think that's going to be some fun reading. This entire series can be found in podcast form as well. Now, if you would like to sip some classical coffee as you read through some classical texts, then please consider ordering a bag of my freshly roasted artisan coffee. You can use the code THECAUSE for 15% off your first order. And I just want to say thank you for everybody who has supported the channel through purchasing coffee. This whole journey has just been a blast so far, and I've really enjoyed kind of creating this little classical community, speaking with you in the comments and stuff like that. It's been amazing. I do want to apologize for kind of the delay in getting this video out. The family's been sick for like 2 weeks now, and it's really set me back on a few things. So we're going to get back to a better posting schedule going forward. And again, I apologize for that. You know, sickness hits, and it's one of them. You know, it was like everybody would get it for 2 or 3 days, and the next person would get it, and the next person would get it, and then the next person would get it. And it's like, I got lucky. I didn't get it the entire time. I'm sitting there like the Matrix is dodging these sick bombs. Anyway, with that being said, read some amazing books, drink some amazing coffee, and I will see you very, very soon. As always, stay blessed. I love y'all. Thank y'all.
I was making lots of noise, busking on the city streets. I came back from Brooklyn, but you didn't come back for me.